Why kids are pouring over the U.S.-Mexico border. Today, Tuesday, July 1st, this is The World. I'm Carol Hills, sitting in for Marco Werman. More than 50,000 kids have been detained at the U.S. border this year. One Salvadoran journalist says parents are desperate enough to send them on their own.
You send your children away because, as every single human being on earth, you want your children to have a decent life.
Plus, Nobel laureate Jody Williams celebrates Forward Movement on banning landmines.
It's about more than the beautiful language of a treaty. It's about the stick-to-itiveness of a movement to make sure the job is done.
And what it takes for those soccer announcers to scream goal.
A lot of these guys did exercises just like singers do. They do the or the, you know, the humming.
I'm Carol Hills, in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. We've been hearing a lot lately about the surge of children trying to cross into the U.S., but it's still hard to fathom. Consider this. Since the beginning of this year, more than 50,000 kids have been detained at the U.S. border with Mexico. Most of them are traveling without their parents from Central America. Carlos Dada is director of the online news service El Faro in San Salvador, El Salvador. And Carlos Dada, what do we know about why these kids are going north by themselves?
Well, there's several reasons to that. Of course, the main one is that they want to be united with their families, most of them living actually in the United States, their parents, and they want to be reunited with their parents. The other reason is, of course, they are running away from violence, from poverty, and I would add, Carol, from the lack of illusions of these countries.
Is there a particular misunderstanding right now in El Salvador that the U.S. has somehow eased up on its immigration policy?
No. On the contrary. It's just that in the case of children, there is a perception that in the case of children, laws will be applied softer, that children will not be deported as easily.
And so you're saying that the rise in the number of children, because I've read that they're as young as, you know, 5 years old and maybe as old as 21, you know, going unaccompanied. The understanding is that it's the parents who are sort of saying, come on up, we know it's going to be safe.
Either from the United States saying, come on up, or from here saying, go away, this place is too dangerous for you, and I don't want my kid to keep growing here. It works both ways. As you know, Carol, the violence has increased in the last years, while the economy has not, specifically in the case of El Salvador. And I would say it's pretty much the same in Honduras and Guatemala.
So describe the situation for many of these kids in El Salvador who are leaving on their own. What kind of life are they having or not having in El Salvador?
Well, if you live in a country where only one fifth to one fourth of the population really can hope for a decent job, then you don't have much high hopes. If you combine with this with the extreme violence and the lack of the presence of the state in many communities which are controlled by gangs or which are controlled by drug cartels, well, then you have an explosive cocktail. It's a lack of hope. So you send your children away because, as every single human being on earth, you want your children to have a decent life. And it's just harder here to get that.
Carlos, do you know anybody personally who's made this decision to have their kid try to go to the border?
Yes, I know somebody, yes.
And how did they make that decision?
Well, exactly because they have been threatened by gangs. In this case, it was a woman whose kid had been threatened by gangs. And she decided to send, she's a single mother. She decided to send her kid to the U.S. for a better future because she was afraid that her kid might end up killed in the streets of San Salvador. In the other case, I met a teenager in the United States who he himself took the road because the gangs were threatening him that if he didn't join the gangs, they were going to kill him. So he decided he wanted to explore a different life.
And how old are these two individuals you're talking about?
The teenager I met was 16 years old, I would guess. The child of this single mother, I don't know, my bet would be like 12 years old, but that's just a guess.
Do you know whether either or both of them made it to the U.S. safely?
Yes. They both did.
What is El Salvador doing to counter this humanitarian crisis?
Well, right now, the government is trying to spread the message that it's dangerous, that you shouldn't send your children. And they are right about it, because all the road through Mexico is one of the most dangerous roads on earth for human beings. So they are trying to spread that message. But then again, necessity is always bigger.
Carlos Dada is director of the El Salvadorian online news service El Faro. Thank you so much, Carlos.
Thank you very much, Carol.
If you remember the Oscar-winning film Missing, you know something about the life and death of reporter Charles Horman. He disappeared in Chile days after General Augusto Pinochet seized power in 1973. Horman's body was found weeks later. He'd been investigating links between the CIA and Chile's military. Decades on, a Chilean court is still investigating Horman's murder. Yesterday, the court ruled that U.S. military intelligence services played a role in the death of Horman and another American, Frank Teruggi. U.S. Navy Captain Ray Davis had offered to help Horman during the chaos of the coup, but the court determined that Davis had in fact passed on information to Chilean officials that led to the men's execution. Joyce Horman was married to Charles Horman. The young couple had set off in a camper van in 1971 to drive to Chile, where the first elected socialist president in Latin America was at the helm.
We found it a very exciting time in Santiago. The populace was thrilled with Allende's election and taking the helm of their own economy. And there was just a level of excitement in the country. So Charles was, of course, reading everything he could read and doing some translating for the Ford Foundation and also working with Americans, translating some American articles about Vietnam for the Chilean press. And before we went down, we were protesting against the war in Vietnam. We were in the women's liberation movement and the civil rights movement. So it was an interesting transition for us to find ourselves in Chile with such an electrified citizenry.
And then you and your husband find yourself in the middle of this coup.
Well, as we came closer to September, there was talk of a coup, but people honestly at that point, because of the history of democracy in Chile, believed it would be a bloodless coup.
And interestingly, it's the U.S. Navy Captain Ray Davis who at the beginning seems to be someone who can help you. And then that changes dramatically.
In his role as a spy master, if I may put it so, he was interested in understanding who Charles was and who we were. And so he was, I don't know if friendly is the right word, but he was amenable to talking and discussion and certainly had plenty of questions that we felt were intrusive.
What does this new court ruling mean to you? What knowledge does it provide you with that you might not have known before?
We did not have the information that Charles and Frank Teruggi were actually tagged by a Chilean naval officer. And that's a direct link with Ray Davis, who was a U.S. Navy official and had very good connections with the Chilean Navy, all the way to the top, to Admiral Huidobro.
Now, Joyce Horman, you've worked for decades to unearth the truth about what happened to your husband. What are you still waiting to learn about his death?
Well, we have the very firm recognition that Ray Davis gave information that then led to Charles and Frank's execution. So at this point, we should reopen the investigation in the United States. We are looking at that as to what exactly it would be pointed at, if it would be just Ray Davis or if it would be the United States government and how much they knew.
You devoted a lot of your life to this, and of course you lost your husband. It was such a tragic situation. What does the case of your husband mean in a larger sense?
Well, for the United States to have a hand in the death of an American journalist 40 years ago and their behavior not having been addressed over 40 years, almost 41 now, permits the same kind of non-democratic, murderous behavior on the part of certain sectors of the U.S. government that need to be investigated. the citizens need to know and need to address this kind of abuse of human rights that the U.S. government inflicted and inflicts on its U.S. citizens.
Joyce Horman, her husband Charles, was murdered after the 1973 coup in Chile. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Landmines are the soldiers that never leave, even when the wars they were deployed to fight are long over. Sometimes they explode generations after they were planted. For Jody Williams, banning landmines has been a personal crusade. The group she founded, the International Campaign to Ban Landmines, won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1997. More than 160 nations have signed the treaty that would ban the production, use, and sale of anti-personnel landmines and destroy stockpiles. But the U.S. is an outlier. It's never signed the treaty. Last week, the Obama administration announced that the U.S. intends to at some point, and it's banning all future production of landmines. Jody Williams says, okay.
It's a good move, except they hadn't been producing them since 1997.
But isn't that in effect a sort of baby step? In all other ways, that they're really kind of living by the treaty. Why not sign it?
That is a question that we have asked forever. You know, a lot of us believe that it really is the Department of Defense being irritated by the fact that civil society, the mine ban movement, and small and medium-sized powers banned a weapon without the U.S. And they've never liked that.
What about more modern landmines that can automatically deactivate after a certain length of time? Are they included in the landmines ban?
Yes, they are. Much to the chagrin of the United States. I mean, that's part of the reason why the U.S. walked out of the treaty negotiations in Oslo in September of 1997. The rest of the world said, no, we don't accept a technological solution. We don't believe there are technological solutions.
Who are the other outliers? What other major countries haven't signed the treaty?
The ones you would expect: Russia, China, India, Pakistan. The stigmatization of the weapon has had a significant impact. And for the first time, China revealed that their stockpile is less than 5 million landmines. That's a huge, significant change in China.
If the U.S. is abiding by the treaty in every other way, why is the U.S. signature to the treaty so important?
In particular, I think because of Mr. Obama's coming into office with, you know, his exclamations of a new multilateralism for the United States, and of course, all of his talk about taking on nuclear weapons, the fact that they won't even sign a treaty that they've been obeying for two decades indicates to other governments that that multilateralism stuff bears no weight in the administration. You can't have it both ways. It's a slap in the face to the rest of the world.
You've been on this issue for many years. Looking back, are you further ahead on it? Do you feel like the world is further ahead on landmines than you imagined even in 1997?
Yes. The world has changed on the ground. Less new landmine victims, 47 million mines in stockpiles of states' parties destroyed that'll never go on the ground. Oman is ready to join, bringing the number up to 162 nations. It's massive. The success of the mine ban treaty is important beyond itself. It demonstrates that these models really work, that it's about more than the beautiful language of a treaty. It's about the stick-to-itiveness of a movement to make sure the job is done.
Jody Williams received the Nobel Peace Prize in 1997, along with the group she founded, International Campaign to Ban Landmines. Jody Williams, thanks so much for speaking to us.
Thank you.
The leader of the Sunni militant group ISIS has a new invitation for Muslims around the globe. Come to Iraq and Syria to help build a new Islamic state there. ISIS wants to create a caliphate on territory that it's seized in the region. Financial Times reporter Borzu Daragahi has been talking to Iraqis in Baghdad. I asked him how people there are reacting to the latest word from ISIS.
Well, a lot of people don't really take this seriously. The mainstream Iraqis in the cosmopolitan, relatively cosmopolitan Baghdad, where I am now, they don't see this as a threat to them in particular. It's a little bit of a clown act to some of the people that I've spoken to. You know, a little bit of a kind of if you think about it, this guy's kind of pulling a Jim Jones there.
You're referring to Jim Jones in Guyana.
Exactly, yes. Yes, I mean, there's a little touch of Jim Jones in what he's doing, essentially declaring himself the Messiah, the leader of all Muslims. I don't think that anyone outside of jihadi, a certain type of jihadi circle, would heed this call or respect it and see it as anything other than the ravings of a nut job.
Now, another scene today, the Iraqi parliament, they're under a lot of pressure to make some progress. They weren't able to elect a speaker. What happened there today?
They were not able to do anything. They were not able to issue a statement that would assure the nation or anything like that. They met. They formally swore in the members who were there. This is the first session after the election on April 30th. And then they had an argument over Kurdish funds, the apportionment of Kurdish funds to the Kurdistan regional government. They broke for a recess, and then essentially they couldn't muster up a quorum again, and they went home until next week. Now, if anyone knows about what's going on in this country right now, I mean, this just shows a complete failure in leadership.
Now, Borzu, you're in Baghdad. You covered it a lot over the past 10 or 12 years, and now you've gone back to cover this story. What's it like being back there?
Well, it's really hot. I mean, seriously hot. It's 122 degrees, and the heat kind of comes at you from below as well as from above. The just sort of bounces off of the asphalt and brushes up against your face. You can feel the heat in a way that is just overwhelming. But I mean, in many ways, the country has changed for the better, believe it or not. Iraqis have more money in their pockets. The streets look nicer. Trash is being picked up. All those buildings that the U.S. Destroyed during the 2003 invasion, they've either been repaired or are being patched up. So the signs of that, the traumatic signs of that war are gone. But yet, you know, the people are in a really bad situation. There's a real fear that the country is facing its gravest, most existential crisis in many decades. People are seriously talking about further partitioning the country, creating a Sunni state or statelet that would be separate from the rest of Iraq. And that is very traumatic for a country where for many years people had this sort of cosmopolitan image of themselves. There is no Sunni, there is no Shia, there is no Kurd, there is no Christian. There are only us Iraqis, and we are unified. And that image of the country has suffered a serious blow.
Borzu Daragahi, reporter in Baghdad. Borzu, appreciate you speaking with us today.
It's always a pleasure.
You're probably getting ready to celebrate July 4th. Are you going to watch a fireworks display? Maybe you're going to a barbecue. For my Canadian colleague, Andrea Crossan, this week is always a bit bittersweet.
I don't want to sound ungrateful. I love living in the United States. But that doesn't mean that I don't miss my home and native land. Especially today. It's Canada Day. We call it Canada's birthday. It actually marks the joining of the British North American colonies of Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, and the province of Canada into the Federation of Four Provinces on July 1st, 1867. Whew, let's just call it Canada Day. Anyway, there are festivals and parades, and where I'm from, they even have lumberjack competitions. Tonight, there'll be fireworks and parties, and I won't be there this year to enjoy Canada Day. So I've asked a few Canadians I know who live outside of the true North, strong and free, how they would celebrate if they were back home. I also asked them for their Canada Day soundtrack.
I'm Derek Stoffel, and I'm from Regina, Saskatchewan. Don't laugh, that's how we pronounce it. I now live in Jerusalem. On Canada Day, what I miss most is heading out to the cottage with some friends and a 2-4. Need translation? That means going out to the lake with 2 dozen beer. It's the most Canadian of pastimes. My favorite Canadian song, 5 Days in May by Blue Rodeo.
They met in a hurricane, standing in the shelter out of the rain. She tucked a note into his hand. Later on, they took his car, drove on down where the beaches are.
Hi, my name is Dara McLeod, and I'm from Thunder Bay, Ontario. I now live in Washington, D.C., and like Derek, the thing I miss most on Canada Day is also being at the cottage. But while I'm there, I don't drink 2-4s. I drink Caesars. And if you don't know what a Caesar is, it's like a Bloody Mary, but made with Clamato juice instead of tomato juice. And trust me, it is a lot better than it sounds. My favorite Canadian song is Helpless by Neil Young, because it reminds me of home.
There is a town in North Ontario. Extreme comfort, memory, despair.
My name is Joe Rothwell. I am from Unionville, Ontario. I currently live in Boston, Massachusetts. The thing I miss most on Canada Day is the cottage and the lake. My favorite Canadian song is Wheat Kings by The Tragically Hip.
Wheat Kings of all treasures buried. All you hear are the rusted breezes pushing around the weather vane Jesus.
My name is James Cowling. I was born in Chilliwack, B.C. I was raised in Calgary, Alberta, and I now live in London, England. We're not as patriotic as our southern neighbors, but on Canada Day, we pull out all the stops. Even tonight, I'm wearing a Canada t-shirt as we speak. It's a day that we can all get away with saying A, out and about, and we generally just have a really good time. The song that I like, I would have to say, If I Had $1 Million by the Bare Naked Ladies.
If I had $1 million,
if I had $1 million,
well, I'd buy you a house,
I would buy you a house.
That's $1 million Canadian dollars, and you can use it to buy that cottage on the lake. Thanks to Derek, Dara, Joe, and James, and to all my fellow Canadians who are celebrating far away from the homeland today. Happy Canada Day. For The World, I'm Andrea Crossan, originally from Vancouver, British Columbia, living in Boston, and this is my song.
Trans-Canada cross, patriotic in a honor with my hand on my heart. From the greatest of lakes to the greenest of greens, to the rockiest mountains and everything in between. Oh, Canada, oh, you're no fan of us, cause our movie and TV shows are so amateur. Yeah, we laugh it off, that don't really bother me. Look, we ain't serious unless we really gotta be. Humorous attitudes like kids in a hall, a Jim Carrey, Mike Myers, how we claiming them all. It's a great white north.
This is PRI. I'm Carol Hills. Ahead, parsing Obama's recent comments on climate change.
Those 10 words from President Obama really constitute one of the most stunning statements ever made by a United States president, because it essentially turns on its head not just Mr. Obama's energy policy, but the energy policy that the United States has been following for many decades.
2 degrees Celsius, about 3 Fahrenheit. That's what the best science tells us, is how much we can let the world warm before climate change turns from serious to catastrophic. The problem is we're headed for a world much hotter than that by the end of this century. And here's the thing, all the current climate change policies combined, the world over, won't keep us in that safe range, including President Obama's new crackdown on power plant emissions. So what do we have to do to keep from passing that 2-degree threshold? Journalist Mark Hertzgart has been covering climate change policy for years, and in his latest piece for Bloomberg Business Week, he reports that President Obama seems to know the answer to that critical question, even if his own policies come nowhere close to achieving it. Mark, what are the presidential tea leaves that you've been reading?
Well, the president gave an interview to Showtime Television's climate series, The Years of Living Dangerously, and in this interview, he was asked, does he know about the latest science that says that 2/3 of the world's known reserves of fossil fuels have to stay unburned if we're to limit the temperature rise to 2 degrees C? And President Obama said yes, that he accepted that. The reporter, Thomas Friedman, followed up and said, quote, so we can't burn it all? And Obama said, we're not going to be able to burn it all, unquote. And I think those 10 words from President Obama really constitute one of the most stunning statements ever made by a United States president, because it essentially turns on its head not just Mr. Obama's energy policy, but the energy policy that the United States has been following for many decades, which is to do as much oil drilling and natural gas exploitation and coal mining as possible.
But I haven't seen much of a response anywhere, particularly in the White House, beyond the comment he made. I mean, what does it matter that he said this in the interview?
I think it always matters what the president of the United States says. Now, as I said in my story in Business Week and in a recent story in Harper's Magazine, Obama's own policies go completely in the other direction here. But let's not lose sight of the international aspect of this. The United States is legally bound by the Copenhagen Accord that Mr. Obama signed and championed at the last climate summit. The United States is legally bound to do what it can to keep temperatures to 2 degrees C. And I think President Obama is clearly looking forward to the next round of international climate negotiations. We're supposed to be signing a treaty in Paris in 2015. So I think Obama is mindful of that and probably trying to create the political space so that he can pursue policies that are more in line with that.
But he's also a lame duck president. Why would he suddenly exert all this energy on climate change if it hasn't happened up until now?
It's taken him 6 years, I think, to realize that he should not have been going the legislative route on this. He spent much of his first year in office trying to push the cap and trade bill, which was doomed, push it through Congress, when in fact he has had in his presidential authority from the day he took office the power to deal with climate change. In fact, the obligation to deal with it under the United States Clean Air Act. So I think Obama sees this as part of his legacy. He's talked repeatedly about his feelings as a father, that this is one of the most important problems facing the United States and the world going forward.
I'm still going to be a skeptic here because we've got huge, you know, the whole world is exploding, huge global economy. I just don't see any indication that there's going to be anything serious that's going to take place. What would you need to do to stop the world from burning all those fossil fuels? What are the alternatives you would have to really put in place?
You know, Germany. Let's start with Germany and California. These are two of the world's most vibrant and innovative and successful economies. Germany has pledged and is well on the way to getting rid of its reliance on not just fossil fuels, but also nuclear power. Here in California, where I live, Governor Jerry Brown has pledged to make the state carbon-free by 2050 and is imposing a lot of policies to do that. You know, meanwhile, one of my favorite examples here is solar power. 15 years ago, very few people had cell phones globally. Now, pretty much everyone has one. Solar power is now growing faster than that, and it's not just in Germany and California, but we have got to bring government policies into line with that 2 degrees Celsius goal. And that's where we need to see more people speaking like President Obama and, above all, putting in place the policies that could make that happen.
Mark Hertzgard covers climate change for The Nation, Harper's, and Bloomberg Business Week, among others. Mark, thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Soccer wouldn't be soccer without... This cry from play-by-play announcers has become a symbol of soccer worldwide, but it actually began in Brazil in the 1940s. Reporter Fernando Santos wrote about the origins of the cry for the New York Times. And Fernando, who was the first Brazilian announcer to scream goal?
It was a man by the name of Rebelo Jr. He was an announcer who realized at some point that to differentiate himself from the other people who were calling the games, he had to come up with something different. Before his time, everybody would just call goal, you know, just kind of like the British announcers who announced the World Cup here in the United States do. And he basically borrowed something that the fans on the stands were already doing, which is this elongated goal cry that's full of emotion, that's kind of guttural and almost cathartic in some ways.
And this was in the 1940s, wasn't it?
Exactly. And at the time, soccer was mostly consumed over the radio, especially in Brazil. I mean, people in the hinterlands would hear soccer games on the radio. My dad going to the stadium, I'm from Brazil, would go and sit with his little radio glued to his ear. And so it was largely a question of bringing the game alive to people who didn't have the benefit of the images on the television screen.
Well, it's been massively successful, and the cry has become so entrenched now in Brazil. that I understand a broadcaster won't be hired unless they're willing to scream goal.
Yeah, you know, I was having a conversation with the director of sports for Globo Television, which is the largest network television station in Brazil. And I said, would you consider, because it seems so vital to the job of a play-by-play announcer, that he said emphatically, no, there's no way we would consider anyone. It's not written on a job requirement sheet, but everybody kind of knows that you have to be able to do that to work in this business.
Now, I know the person many Americans equate with this cheer is Mexican announcer Andres Cantor, but you've written that there are different versions of the cry depending on where you are in the world. What are some of the variations in different countries?
In Germany, the word for goal is Tor, and you can hear announcers going Tor. And all over Latin America is the same way. And Andres Cantor is very well known here. He was at the David Letterman show. The Simpsons featured him. And a lot of people think that he was the first one to do that because for Americans, he sort of made that famous, but the cry of goal precedes him by decades.
Now, I know when you researched the story for the New York Times, you found out that these play-by-play announcers actually have various ways to condition their vocal cords to be ready for the scream. What did they tell you that they did?
Narrating a soccer game is an exhausting job. It's not a game like baseball that has a lot of slow, quiet moments. It's a game where there's always something going on. So not only do these announcers have to have their voice conditioned to carry the whole narration of the game, but also to be able to scream goal without their voices faltering as they're doing that. There's something called the Tarzan goal, which goes go when, you know, they're not really well prepared. A lot of these guys did exercises just like singers do. They do the or they, you know, the humming. They don't drink distilled beverages because for some reason it affects the chemical balance of your vocal cords. They do things like eating apples before a game because the apples moisten the vocal cords. One of them in specific, José Carlos Araújo, took singing lessons at the beginning of his career to learn how to project his voice. And these days, it's much more common that they will have the help of a phonoaudiologist to help them do the same and not get tired and out of breath.
Wow, sound like opera singers preparing for a performance.
As a matter of fact, Galvão Bueno, who is the one who has the apples before he starts narrating a game, he compared the cry of goal to the tenor high C, which anyone who understands opera knows is one of the most challenging notes a tenor can sing.
Fernando, you grew up in Brazil going to many soccer games. I'm wondering who your favorite announcer is for the cry goal.
Well, you know, I have a place in my heart for José Carlos Araújo, and that has a lot to do with the fact that my father is a rabid soccer fan, and he would pick me up in school, and we would go to the games. He roots for a team that is not really a great team at all, but that's passion, right? You go, you support your team, and he would sit there with his little radio, and I could hear the voice of José Carlos Araújo every time any team scored. It was mostly the opposing team. When I met José Carlos Araújo, I had to hug him because it was kind of like meeting a piece of my past.
Well, we have José Carlos Araújo queued up for our listeners to experience. But first, Fernando, who are you rooting for this World Cup?
Oh, gosh, Brazil. I am 40 years old. I moved to this country. I was 26. I love the United States, but my heart, my soul, everything about me is Brazilian. So Brazil all the way.
Well, go Brazil. Fernando Santos reported on the origins of the announcers screaming goal for the New York Times. Thanks, Fernando.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
So how do you say goal in Urdu? Pakistan isn't in the World Cup, but you might not know it, judging by the way people there are reacting. When Brazil beat Chile on Saturday, one small neighborhood in Pakistan was celebrating like it was their national team. Fahad Desmuk reports from Karachi.
Liari is one of Karachi's slums and one of the oldest neighborhoods in the city. The place is mostly known for the violence and gang warfare that has ravaged the area since the late 1990s. But Liari has another legacy that goes much further back, and that is soccer, or football as we call it. Cricket is overwhelmingly the most popular sport in most of Pakistan, but here in Liari, football is king, especially during the World Cup finals. In dozens of spots around the neighborhood, people drag television sets and projectors onto the street to watch the weekend's knockout match between Brazil and Chile. Yeah. Almost everyone I speak with supports Brazil, and they're quick to remind me that Liari has been labeled mini Brazil because of this support. God willing, Brazil will win today and it will keep on winning, says one kid. Others shout at me about their love for their hero, the star forward Neymar.
He's my best friend, Neymar!
As one of British India's key seaports in the early 20th century, many ships carrying European sailors would dock in Karachi. In their leisure time, visiting sailors would play soccer near the harbor and would invite locals, including people from Liari, to join them.
This became a tradition that whenever they came, these people used to go there and they played with them.
Nadir Shah Adil is a veteran journalist from Liari. He says while much of Pakistan took on the British game of cricket, people in Liari chose soccer. Why? Probably for the most obvious reasons, he says. It's cheaper. And as for the overwhelming support for Brazil, Adil says the downtrodden folks here feel an ethnic affinity. Like many Brazilian players, many people in Liari are of African ancestry as a result of the slave trade.
They feel great resemblance when they feel, when they see, when they look, and when they experience that Pele is just as they are. They see their faces in their own facial mirrors. They feel similarity. They feel sentimental attachment.
The attachment to the Brazilian pros isn't just sentimental. The Liari neighborhood has come to be known as the breeding ground for some of Pakistan's biggest stars. On the streets, I met several current or former professional players. Ghulam Shabir is currently an assistant coach for the National Bank of Pakistan's team. He tells me, if you're from Liari and you don't make it in sports, you're out of luck.
I have a master's degree, but it's of no use. We are only given jobs because we are sportsmen. Because of the address on our ID cards, we are accused of being gangsters and terrorists. So if we don't play sports, then we'll go hungry.
But even the opportunity for sports is drying up. The golden days of soccer in Liari were in the 60s, when the bulk of Pakistan's national football team was made up of players from there. But now, there are better facilities and training academies in other parts of the country. So, Liari has been left behind. And there's the neighborhood's well-deserved reputation for crime and gang violence. Last year, someone bombed a youth soccer tournament, killing 11 people, including several children. But that's not dimming the passion here for the World Cup, or for Brazil. At the end of last weekend's game, the score was tied at 1-1 after extra time, and it came down to a shootout. Everyone was on the edge of their seats. The Chilean player went for a kick and missed, and Brazil won. Everyone jumped to their feet, running around with Brazilian flags. It was just as big a win for Liari as it was for the World Cup host. For The World, I'm Fahad Desmukh in Karachi, Pakistan.
I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. Iceland seems like one big joke, an island in the middle of nowhere with a name that doesn't make sense and people who still believe in elves. Well, maybe not the young people. And then there's Iceland's near-total financial meltdown in 2008, far more apocalyptic than here in the U.S. That was when the joke darkened. But not for long, because the voters of Reykjavik, Iceland's capital, reacted in an unlikely way to the crisis. They put a professional comedian in the mayor's office. That man, Jón Gunnar, recently completed his term, and he spoke with the World's language editor, Patrick Cox.
On the night he was elected in June 2010, Jón Gunnar made this promise to his supporters.
I'm not going to say a welcome to the revolution!
Welcome to the revolution. Sounds very punk rock, which is kind of what it was. Jón Gunnar, former punk, anarchist and surrealist comedian, was the new mayor of a city whose people were desperate. Their bank accounts decimated, their futures thrown into doubt. They'd just voted for a man who, in his campaign, had promised, among other things, to end all debt. Forever. His political party, a new one, was made up of artists and musicians, and it had a memorable name.
In Icelandic, it's
Besti flokkurinn,
which translates roughly to the best party. Part of the name's appeal was the pun in English. You know, I was at the best party last night. Even though the pun doesn't work in Icelandic, Gunnar says most people got the joke anyway. And the whole thing was a joke, this political campaign, until it ceased to be, which was...
probably not until right after I got elected.
And that was when Gunnar realized he'd have to make good on his campaign promises, not literally on things like ending debt or reducing the number of Santas to one, but on something. He immediately ran into problems. There were insults from real politicians who told him...
that I am incapable of doing my job, I'm not qualified, and that I'm a clown.
And they tried to show him up, Gunnar says, by using the densest possible bureaucraties.
I master the Icelandic language very well. I'm very good at Icelandic. But in Iceland, like in many other countries, the political culture has evolved into some sort of a subculture with a different language. They have terms and words that ordinary people just don't understand.
Gunnar and his best party colleagues countered this way of talking by satirizing it to the point of absurdity. They came up with fake initiatives, outrageously condescending ones, supposed to show how much they cared about certain groups, like the disabled and women.
I openly said that we were willing to listen more to women. We would even have meetings with women and we would record everything that they had to say so that future generations could listen to it. And introducing like a hotline where you could call a certain toll-free number and listen to women.
Gunnar knew he was treading a fine line, but most people seemed to get what he and his colleagues were up to.
We may be playful, and sometimes I will sound ridiculous, but I'm harmless.
There were some of Reykjavik's residents who wanted him to be a little less harmless, a little more rage against the machine. But that was never Gunnar's revolution. Yes, he was tapping into the outrage at the political and business cabal that had ruled Iceland. His response was to poke fun at it, show it up as irresponsible, and leave Icelandic voters in a better position to make more informed choices next time. And funnily enough, this one-time anarchist high school dropout is now regarded as having brought much-needed stability to the mayor's office. He generally didn't interfere with the day-to-day running of Reykjavik. He left that to the city managers. Instead, he pushed hard on issues like gay rights and improving public spaces, while also overseeing painful budget cuts. Most refreshing for many was his refusal to run for a second term. And leaving politics has allowed Gunnar to write a book and visit the United States.
My first time in the U.S. was in 1989, and people would ask me where I was from, and I would say I was from Iceland, and nobody had a clue what I was talking. They didn't know what Iceland was. But nowadays, when I'm somewhere and being asked, where are you from? And I say, I'm from Iceland, and people would say, ah, Björk.
Björk, perhaps inevitably, is a close friend of Gunnar's. And as well known as she is around the world, Gunnar is also making a name for himself, also becoming a sort of cultural ambassador for Iceland. He jokes that the country should rename itself Björkland in recognition of its artistic riches.
Once I was in a radio debate with the former mayor, and she said that we were just a bunch of artists, and she spoke of artists like some subhumans or something, like people who can't pay their bills or organize their daily life or something. And that made me very angry. And I said, what is this country of ours famous for, if not art and artists? From the early beginning with writing and the sagas and then with, especially with music. Iceland is world known for its music and its musicians. I compare claustrophobia, crystalline, and
demon the light. It's not clear, even to young Gunnar, what's next for him. He says he's still trying to make sense of his 4 years in power. He's none too happy with the results of Reykjavik's recent elections. Young voters stayed away from the polls. His political allies didn't do well, while a party that opposes the construction of what would be Reykjavik's first mosque did do well. Gunnar's only plans for now are, as you might expect, out of left field.
I will definitely go to Texas, but I'm not sure what I'm going to do there. But I have noticed that many of my followers on Facebook, for instance, are from Texas. So I'll definitely have to go there and talk to the Texans.
And who knows where that will lead? Sitting mayors in the Lone Star State facing re-election? You've been warned. For The World, I'm Patrick Cox.
There's more from young Gunnar in our language podcast, The World in Words. You can hear about his unsuccessful attempts to get the name Jón Gunnar officially recognized by the Icelandic government. He was born Jón Gunnar Kristinsson, and that's still the name in his passport. To hear more, go to pri.org/language. The music you're hearing comes from Björk's latest release, and she'll be very much flying the flag for Iceland next year when New York's Museum of Modern Art stages a retrospective of her career. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for joining us.